the Sci-Fi Show. Welcome to episode 10 of the Sci-Fi Show. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Seems we have nearly 400 listeners for the latest show, which is great. Continues to grow. Apparently, I'm listed on Skepticality as one of their links they like, which is great. Now, if I can just get them to play my promo, that'd be great. They've got heaps of listeners. Also, with this week's show, I'm going to try something different. I'm going to try a more casual, winging it approach to doing the discussion today. Hopefully, that'll work out okay. Well, I'm still planning to edit and clean it up a bit at the end, but I'll be going from talking points and making it up as I go along. Let me know if you like this approach, or if you prefer I just write a script and read from it like I've been doing in the past. Anyway, today's episode is going to look at the 1997 Richard Zemeckis film Contact, based on the novel Contact by Carl Sagan. It stars Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey, and hopefully everyone's had a chance to see it. It's not a bad film, I quite liked it, and I think it will provide an interesting discussion of a number of ideas, notably the Drake equation, the idea of faith, and it even briefly touches on the concept of intelligent design. Ha! Better get everybody's hackles up at that mention. I guess I'll get on with the show and start with a recap as usual. The story of Contact is a relatively simple one. It centres around the character of Ellie Arroway and her work with SETI, and what happens when SETI gets a message. And this message turns out to have all manner of information hidden in it on how to build a vehicle that lets you travel between the stars. Well, indirectly via something akin to the Stargate wormholes. The end of the movie has Ellie travelling through this tunnel and meeting with an alien somewhere at the centre of the galaxy, if I understand correctly. And then she's returned to Earth, but on Earth, they can't tell that she's travelled anywhere at all, as her trip appeared to be completely instantaneous. And with the end of the film, you have Ellie asserting that she had this experience, that it was real, and there's some evidence, but the evidence is somewhat inconclusive in favour of her story. And the question you're left with at the end is she to be believed? One of the other characters in the film, Palmer Joss, who is this pseudo-religious figure, says he does believe Ellie, and the movie ends there. The book is different, and a group of them actually travel, and ends with a strange story about Ellie searching through all of the digits of pi, looking for a pattern. Anyway, I think that's enough of a recap for the purposes of the discussion itself. I got a few clips from the movie that illustrate some good points. Okay, we'll be back right after these messages.
Got Narn on your noodle? Seeing Centauri in your cereal? Is there a hole in your mind? If so, go to www.babylonpodcast.com. There you'll find the only podcast dedicated to Babylon 5. You'll hear in-depth commentary, insightful interviews, and unexpected surprises. The Babylon Podcast, our last and best hope for B5 fans.
Welcome back. The first thing I think it's worth having a look at is the idea of the Drake equation. This is found in the movie when Ellie is talking to Palmer about the nature of the universe and how big it is. This clip is illustrative.
Yeah, there are 400 billion stars out there just in our galaxy alone. If only one out of a million of those had planets, all right, and if just one out of a million of those had life, and if just one out of a million of those had intelligent life, there would be literally millions of civilizations out there.
The Drake equation itself was derived by Frank Drake at the University of California, Santa Cruz in the 1960s. As you can guess from the clip, he was trying to estimate the number of extraterrestrial civilizations in our galaxy that we might come into contact with. The idea of the equation was to let scientists quantify factors which would help determine the number of extraterrestrial civilizations. In recent years, the idea has come under some criticism, although interestingly, the Drake equation itself was cited by Gene Roddenberry in support of all the different alien races you find in the Star Trek universe. The Drake equation itself goes something like this. N, the number of civilizations in our galaxy, which we might be able to communicate with, is equal to the rate of star formation in the galaxy times the fraction of those stars which have planets times the average number of planets which can potentially support life times the fraction of those planets which actually go on to develop life times the fraction of the above which actually go on to develop intelligent life times the fraction of the above which are willing and able to communicate times the expected lifetime of such civilizations. Included in the show notes, you'll find a link to the PBS website, which has an interactive Drake equation as a flash animation that you can play with. When Frank Drake first described the equation, he selected values of 10 per year for the rate of star formation, a half for the fraction of those stars which have planets, 2 for the number of planets which can potentially support life for each star that has planets, 1 for the fraction of those which actually go on to develop life, 0.01 for the number that will go on to develop intelligent life, and the same again for those that will be willing to communicate, and the expected lifetime of such civilizations to be 10 years. At the time, in 1960, when he first came up with it, the human race had on Earth been around for about 10 years in a way that could actually communicate or be detected by other civilizations in the galaxy. So 10 was a reasonable estimate at the time, given we could have destroyed ourselves at any time in the last 50-odd years. The value now for the lifetime of the civilization could be put at 50 years. I suppose we'll be able to get a definitive upper bound sometime in the near future if someone manages to destroy all of the civilizations on Earth. Oh well, wait and see. Perhaps we can nail that parameter down finally. Not sure that'd be a good thing, though. Carl Sagan, in line with Ali Arroway, oddly enough, thought that the values that should be plugged into the Drake equation were fairly high, and that the chance of finding other civilizations would be quite good. Which leads into a related idea to the Drake equation, and that's what's called the Fermi paradox. The Fermi paradox was proposed by Enrico Fermi, of all people, when he was speculating about the existence of technologically advanced civilizations within the observable universe and exactly how common they should be, in line with Drake. To sum the Fermi paradox up, essentially it's saying if the values plugged into the Drake equation are quite high and that these are reasonable, and that there should be lots of other extraterrestrial intelligent civilizations out there, where are they? The paradox can be stated more fully as follows. The belief that the universe contains many technologically advanced civilizations, combined with our complete lack of observational evidence to support that view, is inconsistent. Either this assumption is incorrect, and technologically advanced civilizations are much rarer than we believe, our current observations are incomplete, and we may simply have not have detected them yet, or our search methodologies are flawed, and we are not searching for the correct indicators. But who is right? Is Fermi correct and the life isn't out there to be found? Or was Drake right and we just haven't found it yet? I suppose depending on which side of that assumption you fall will determine whether you think something like SETI is a good idea or a complete waste of time. One side seems to agree with Ellie's dad, who said,
"If it is just us, it seems like an awful waste of space."
While others might agree with myself and the psalmist, who said, "The heavens declare the glory of God and the skies proclaim his name." I don't see why all of the universe has to be wasted space just because there's nobody living there. After all, I've looked at plenty of pictures from space, and I have to say, the universe, even if there's no one out there, provides a canvas for artwork that is unrivaled by anything humans could even hope to do. But that's just me. Probably the most interesting thing about the Drake equation I've found is that it actually does provide a really good measure of something. I just don't think that something is the amount of intelligent life in the universe. What it provides an excellent estimate of is the faith the person making the assumption has about the amount of life in the universe. After all, the Drake equation, depending on the values you plug in, will yield vastly different results, from the chance of any life in the universe is close to zero to many millions and millions of worlds out there, all depending on the starting assumptions. So I think it tells you something about the person employing it more than it actually tells you anything concrete about the number of civilizations in the universe. I think the next interesting topic you find in the movie is the idea of intelligent design. Clearly this signal that's come from another planet, from Vega, was sent by intelligent authors that the people on Earth know nothing about. It's interesting that SETI essentially used something akin to William Dembski's explanatory filter to know whether a signal they've received is a naturally occurring phenomenon or something else. This signal received in contact clearly falls through the explanatory filter and yields the correct conclusion. After all, a sequence of prime numbers has a specification, which is a sequence of prime numbers that is unrelated to the mechanism that generates it. There's nothing we know in nature that will produce a sequence like this through law or random chance. The sequence is just too long for that to be a probable explanation. And so, the SETI team correctly infers that we have a signal from an intelligent author, and they look at the signal further to find yet more information encoded within it. I just thought that was worth noting. Seems strange. When SETI does it, it's science and a good thing and worth doing, and when you try to apply the same principle to biology, you're attempting to establish a theocracy and teach everybody that the Earth is 6,000 years old. I don't get that. But anyway, let's move on. Another interesting part of the film occurs at the end, after Ellie has had a trip through the wormhole and comes back. But from the observers on Earth, it looks like nothing has happened. She has this 18-hour story of travelling down the wormhole and all the rest of it and meeting with the aliens. And yet the evidence back on Earth is at best inconclusive as to the truth of her story, which presents an interesting dilemma. You see the skeptics in the inquiry that won't take a story seriously and just say, look, we saw it with our own eyes, you're full of crap. Clearly, you're insane. Or things more or less to that effect. And yet you see Palmer Joss and others who get behind her and believe what she says. It presents an interesting conundrum. Who do you believe? After all, Ellie could be lying, but there doesn't seem to be any reason for her to make the story up. This seems particularly unlikely that she's a liar. She could be a lunatic. This is possible too. But she seems to be in perfect mental health, and it doesn't seem like she's crazy or foaming at the mouth. She certainly doesn't exhibit any of the symptoms you'd expect from someone who is actually genuinely delusional. So it's a fair bet she's not a lunatic. Which leaves us with the final conclusion that she's in fact telling the truth. I guess the question to ask is she a reliable witness? Or are you going to write her off as a liar or a lunatic? Liar or lunatic seem like an unlikely conclusion, and Palmer Joss, knowing Ellie and trusting her, and knowing that she probably doesn't have any reason to lie, and she certainly doesn't look insane, believes the story and takes it at face value. I think I've heard something like that somewhere before. Anyway, just to round the discussion out, Ellie makes a very interesting observation during a conversation with Palmer Joss at the dinner before she goes. And it seems a particularly double-minded observation, if I do say so myself.
Come on, it's like you're saying that science killed God. What if science simply revealed that he never existed in the first place?
Now I've heard others make these sort of conclusions in the past. It's always struck me as interesting. It seems, certainly with the rise of intelligent design recently, that God has no place in science and it's untestable and all the rest of it, and you're not allowed to draw conclusions that point in that direction. Or so I'm continually told by people. Yet, here, Ellie, and certainly others I've heard, are saying science gives us reason to think God doesn't exist, based on whatever it concludes about the universe. Now, does something strike you as amiss here, or is it just me? Science can show that God doesn't exist, but if science points towards God, then that's an illegitimate conclusion and doesn't belong. Seems like a bit of a double standard. If you admit that science can furnish evidence that God does not exist, then you have to concede, if you're going to be honest, you can always be dishonest, I suppose, that science could likewise furnish evidence for the existence of God. And if you want to avoid that tack and say that science can't provide evidence either way, you can do that. But people seem unwilling to take this tack. After all, they want to say something like a soul, which is immaterial and beyond the detection of science, can't be found anywhere according to science and neurology and all the rest of it. And so there's evidence to think it doesn't exist, but no evidence would be accepted for the existence of a soul from science, saying, oh, that's beyond the scope of science, that's religion. But which is it? You can't have it both ways. Either science can provide evidence either way, or it can't. This double standard annoys me, as you might imagine. Anyway, it should make for some interesting discussion on the forums, at least. And that's where we'll leave the discussion of contact, and now I'll play probably the most ironic advert ever.
Welcome to the realm of skepticality. What is skepticality? Skepticality is a podcast for those of us who view the world in a skeptical way. We do our best to find the truth behind the news, urban legends, UFOs, paranormal encounters, science, underreported social issues, and historical misconceptions.
You just don't get it.
Do you have a problem with the news? Do you like to make fun of those neighbors with tinfoil hats? Do you want to learn some new stuff? Do you want to get something you're not going to hear on your 24-hour McNews channel? Or the local radio dial.
Sure, yeah.
Right. Then tune in by visiting us at www.skepticality.com.
Spell it.
That's SKEPTICALITY.com. Grab a couple of shows and stick them in your ear.
Ooh, it's waxy in there.
And by all means, don't listen to that voice in my head.
Voice? What voice?
No voice.
Skepticality. Truth. In podcasting.
Well, that brings us to the end of the show. I haven't received much in the way of feedback of late. Did receive an email complimentary of the show from someone else who disagrees with me philosophically on most things, which seems to be most of the listeners. So I'm glad you listen. I hope you enjoy the show. And I received another email asking where I was. Sorry again that this is late, everyone. Hopefully it won't be like that again. As usual, if you have any feedback about the show, you can send me an email, thescifishow@gmail.com, or come to the forums, thescifishow.free-forums.org. All the links can be found at the blog, thescifishow.blogspot.com. On next time's show, I'm going to be looking at different conceptions of what a soul is, and I'll be using the Babylon 5 episode Soul Hunter to have a look at it from Season 1. Quite a good episode if you can get around to having a look at it in the meantime. Now to finish the show out, I thought I'd play another tune by Jonathan Coulton, because I really like his music. And this song, Skull Crusher Mountain, I enjoyed it, and my wife likes it too. Anyway, talk to you next time.
Welcome to my secret lair on Skull Crusher Mountain. I hope that you've enjoyed your stay so far. I see you've met my assistant Scarface. His appearance is quite disturbing, but I assure you he's harmless enough. He's a sweetheart, calls me master, and he has a way of finding pretty things and bringing them to me. Monster to please you, but I get the feeling that you don't like it. What's with all the screaming? You like monkeys, you like ponies. Maybe you don't like monsters so much. Maybe I use too many monkeys. Isn't it enough to know that I ruined a pony making a gift for you? Atmosphere, and all the fools who lead their foolish lives may find it quite explosive. Well, it won't mean half as much to me if I don't have you here. No, it isn't easy living here on Skullcrusher Mountain. Maybe you could cut me just a little slack. Would it kill you to be civil? I've been patient, I've been gracious, and this mountain is covered with wolves. Hear them howling, my hungry children. Maybe you should stay and have another drink and think about me and you.
This program is copyright Jason Rennie 2005 and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. The song Electrogun was used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great sci-fi surf guitar can be found at www.novasurfer.nl.